Good morning and welcome to Radio National Breakfast. Fran Kelly with you on this Friday, the 15th of April. Putting food first to protect the poor. The World Bank says global food prices are pushing more people into poverty. The line the share market refuses to cross. Why can't the index smash the 5,000 point level? And on our Friday panel, the journey that is welfare to work. It's easy to say and so much harder to do.
I have been going every day on the net, every night I'm up until 2 a.m. going through the net, and I'm looking for work, and there's, you know, everyone wants a uni degree or they want this and that, and I didn't go to university, but I know, like, I'm a very smart person. I catch on very quickly, and it is so hard, even just to get a job down at the corner shop pulling coffees now, is they want, you know, barista certificate here and this and that there, and it's, you know, we don't, as if anybody wants to live on the amount of money we actually live on each fortnight.
That's right, Sarah. She spent the last 2 years on and off the Newstart allowance, and she says it's not easy to get off welfare and into work. She gets paid $570 a fortnight in benefits. That's under the Newstart scheme. She pays $330 of that in rent. That leaves her $240 to live for 2 weeks. The Prime Minister, of course, says everyone who can work should work, but Sarah says she'd like the PM to walk in her shoes. We'll discuss welfare to work initiatives, what has worked, what hasn't over the decades, on our Friday panel after 8 this morning. And we'll also head down to the Quilters Convention in Melbourne today, where it's patchwork versus pieces of art and machinist versus the hand stitches.
There are still traditionalists, and I respect those traditionalists, and I really, really admire traditional quilter who does magnificent quilting and so forth.
And in Australia, I'd imagine this is a very social thing to do, that people would get together to quilt together. In fact, I've heard it referred to sometimes as stitch and bitch.
I believe, you know, the girls sort of, you know, swap notes on all sorts of things, you know, all the marital problems and all the rest of it. So it does become, you know, a little bit of a, I suppose, stitch and bitch. Yeah.
That's Trevor Reed. He's a quilting veteran of 30 years. He's hosting a series of classes at the 7th Australasian Quilt Convention underway in Melbourne. And he's one of many blokes around the world who've taken up the needle and thread and are into quilting. Can he convince our reporter, Mike Woods, to do the same? I know Mike has some time on his hands. Mike reports after 8. Fran Kelly with you on this Friday morning. It's 6:08 on Radio National Breakfast. The energy giant BP has faced angry protesters in London at its first annual general meeting since the disastrous oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico 12 months ago. Several fishermen from the Gulf have travelled to the meeting, but even with proxy votes in hand, they were refused entry, much to their dismay. They wanted to tell BP shareholders that they'd received a fraction of the multi-billion dollar compensation promised by BP. Louisiana oyster farmer Byron Encalade was there. He joins you now from London. Byron, welcome to ABC Radio National Breakfast.
Thank you for having me.
Byron, why were you refused entry to the BP's annual general meeting?
Well, it still haven't been clear to us. The only thing we were asked was where we were from, and proudly we told them we were from Louisiana, and that was it. The next thing we know, we were asked, they're going to escort us in. That never did happen, and then they closed the doors and told us that we were denied entry. So, you know, and that's basically all we have from any official from BP. They did contact us through another source and not directly and tried to arrange a meeting, but we're very proud people. When somebody closed the door in our face, that means leave, you know, and that's the way we took it. And but we still invited them to come down to the bayous and eat some gumbo, and maybe they can enjoy some of our southern hospitality like they've done in the past. We've never treated BP personnel wrong or bad. We've always opened our doors to try to work with them to resolve this for both our interests, you know.
It's a long way from the bayous to London. Why did you travel all that way to try and attend this meeting?
Well, because the claims process, we're not getting the funds. Our communities are on the verge of going into poverty. Our senior citizens and our fishermen are hurting. They're not. They haven't received interim payments like they were promised. It's been almost a year now, and some fishermen have received little money at all. some fishermen have received $5,000-$10,000, and I mean, it's just ridiculous. How do you support a family off of $5,000-$10,000 for a whole year? Now the whole community is on the verge of bankruptcy because of the simple reason we all been helping each other.
Mm.
So those that did have a little opportunity to make some money, like one of my boats, we spread that around maybe 6-7 families, you know. So, I mean, you can only stretch something so far, you know.
How much money have you received from BP, Byron?
Well, my company's received, but it's not my money.
Yeah.
It belongs to my workers, my captains, my brother, who was denied an interim claim after the first 10,000. So I have all of these people that I have to be responsible for. That's what they don't understand about family fisheries. I'm not in this by myself.
Mm.
I have my nephews, my truck drivers that I had to lay off, trucks, equipment I had to sell off to keep them going.
And so how much money has the company got from the fund so far?
Well, the company have gotten and received a check for $70,000. Half of that was 9 months ago. Half of that went into the repairs of the two boats. I just had two boats on the shipyard that cost me $20,000-some just to do regular maintenance on. That's not no damage that BP occurred to my vessel, but we have to maintain these vessels. Then when you look trying to support two and three families off of that, I've been back into my money for almost 7-8 months now, you know.
So that's not, you're right, that's not much money, yet BP is telling everyone publicly that it's set up this fund of $30 billion to pay for the cleanup bill and compensate fishermen. I'm not sure what the split of that is, but what's the process for trying to get the money from BP, and why isn't it coming? Is there more money coming your way?
Well, we've been trying to figure that out ourselves. I mean, I know I have all my documentation, my captains, and my brother, who is the fleet commander of our of the family business. He's got his income tax papers and stuff. I don't know what more they want. Every time I turn around, they're asking me for the same information for the fishermen. I mean, I spend more time writing up documents for the fishermen and the 12, 13 people that work on my boats and trucks than I spend doing anything. I mean, it's never enough. It's really sad. But then we hear that people working on jobs, getting checks every week, every Friday, never lost their job, never lost income. They're the ones receiving checks. And these fishermen who've been unemployed now for a year, And the scientific data that's coming out is showing that we could be out of work for 4 to 10 years.
Let me ask you about that. I wanted to know, you haven't been able to resume the oyster farming yet?
No, all our oysters are dead. I've lost over $1 million worth of oysters and damage to my oyster beds. I mean, we had our boats. We just were in a recovery process from Katrina. I got two boats back. I lost five in a hurricane that were either damaged or destroyed. We were managed to get two back to work this year. Then come the oil spill, we were producing 50 to 60, 70 sack of oysters a day just with one small boat. The big boat was due to go to work. And, I mean, all of this was stopped. Trucks, I've had to sell off most of my trucking company and equipment to just keep us going. I mean, you can't just keep doing this.
Is the government in there helping, or do you feel abandoned by BP and the government?
Well, I mean, the government, we are talking to our government, and they are being told the same thing by Mr. Feinberg and BP. We're going to make these people whole. You know, it's not our government or the taxpayers' responsibility to take care of this. The responsible parties have made a commitment to make the people whole. We need to hold them to their word and make them deliver. It's time to deliver now. All the excuses, oh, this one or that, and one blaming it on the other one, that's why it was imperative that we come to London and hear for ourselves. And I tell you, I'm hearing some very disturbing things. I get off the plane and meeting with the good people of London, and some very kind people who have treated us real nice. Telling us, well, they're under the impression that everything is cleaned up in the Gulf and people are going back to work. They were shocked when in some of the conversations I had with the local people, that these families are still out of work, and the fishermen aren't receiving the compensation for it.
I think that's it. You've got to keep spreading the word, Byron. Thank you very much for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you for having us.
That's Byron Inkelade. He's a Louisiana oyster farmer who travelled to London for BP's first AGM since the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico about 12 months ago. It's 24 past 6 on Radio National Breakfast.
Hello, Damien Carrick here. Coming up in the national interest, the 729,000 informal votes in last year's federal election. That's more than all the registered voters in the Northern Territory, the ACT and Tasmania combined. Why are some ballots blank, others defaced and way too many incorrectly completed? And what can we do to reduce these figures? That's In the National Interest with me, Damien Carrick, today after the 6pm news on ABC Radio National, after 4 in the West.
Some suggest the quality of our political debate might help. It's 26 past 6 on Radio National Breakfast. James Carlton up in just a second with some newspaper headlines. But first, let's check the weather as we head into the weekend. In Broome today, mostly sunny and 35. Perth, sunny skies and 31. Adelaide, fine, partly cloudy and 22. In Melbourne, showers clearing later in the day, heading for a top of 21 degrees. Hobart, some morning drizzle around, heading for a top of 15, warming up slightly over the weekend. Albury-Wodonga, partly cloudy and 22. In Canberra, possible showers and 20 degrees. Sydney, possible showers developing and 23. Newcastle, partly cloudy and 23. In Brisbane, afternoon showers and 28. Townsville, fine today, 29 degrees. Cairns, fine and 30 degrees. Darwin, afternoon and overnight storms and 31 degrees. And in Alice Springs today, mostly sunny, cooler and 26 degrees. It's 27 past 6. James Carlton, good morning.
Good morning, Fran. Having a look at the markets, we have London down 46 points. That's minus 0.8%. The US flat again, just like yesterday. Only a tiny increase, around 0.1%. Now, the papers. And there are people about who don't much care for the independents who are holding the lower house balance of power, and they're prepared to tell the press about it. Let's start with the Sydney Daily Telegraph. They have a former Duntroon student accusing the independent MP Andrew Wilkie of forcing him to make a Nazi salute 28 years ago during one of those bastardisation ceremonies at the military college. This same story from Andrew Rule, even more prominent in his hometown paper, which is the Melbourne Herald Sun. Wilkie's colour picture covering the front page. Nazi slur, the headline. Allegations of dark past catch up with MP who holds the balance of power. It's the Hobart Mercury as well, significant because you would have thought, what with the christening of Princess Mary and Prince Frederick's twins, that would have been the dominating story. Instead, it has to share the front page with the Andrew Wilkie story. The Melbourne Age, meanwhile, has a photo of another independent MP, Rob Oakeshott. He's trekking in Malaysia to commemorate the Sandakan Death March. Liberal Scott Morrison, Labor's Jason Clare, both in the photo as well. The trip, we learn, is sponsored by Clubs Australia, which, of course, is behind this current anti-pokey reform campaign. Also in the Age, though, we have safety on Melbourne's rail network, a more traditional story for the papers. It's in the hands of a skeleton staff of transit police, say the paper. Only 72 transit officers in Melbourne will be working today, covering 15 train lines and over 2,000 scheduled services. There is terrible news on the roads, however. The Northern Territory news, 14-year-old boy dead and 5 injured in a horror crash in Palmerston. In the WA paper, we have boy 15 dead and another clings to life after a police chase crash. In the Adelaide Advertiser, street races grim reality. A split-second decision to race a friend down a suburban Adelaide street some time ago cost Ricardo Rocha a mate and a leg. Now it may cost him his freedom, found guilty yesterday by a jury. Also in the Adelaide paper, we have a tug-of-war for jobs. The copper miner Oz Minerals is trying to poach workers for South Australia from WA and Queensland. It's taking its recruitment battle to interstate airport terminals with advertisements encouraging fly-in, fly-out workers to instead fly into Adelaide as well. And we have skills bills in the Brisbane Courier-Mail. The Gillard government planning to slug large employers who use low-skilled foreign workers as part of a multi-billion dollar push to tackle the skills shortage in the country. Also, the Sydney Morning Herald. Judge scolds crime body over deals. The judges criticise the New South Wales Crime Commission for arguing that doing deals with criminals without proper court approval was a long-standing practice, and they didn't agree with that. That's the papers, Fran.
Thanks very much, James. News coming up, and then Chris Smith joins us with science news and some new insights into schizophrenia. It's 6:30. Good morning. You're listening to ABC Radio National Breakfast. Fran Kelly with you on this Friday, the 15th of April. And coming up in a moment, we're going to be joined by the lead author of the World Bank's latest report into food prices. World food prices have risen. The price of food has risen 36% in 12 months. That has pushed tens of millions more people into poverty. If we talk about poverty as living on less than $1.25 a day. Also, the Australian Transport Safety Bureau has released its report on the grounding of the Chinese coal carrier. Remember, the Shenneng 1 rammed into the Great Barrier Reef last year? Well, the inquiry has found a series of errors, obviously, including and perhaps predominantly human fatigue. That story coming up. It's 24 to 7. Schizophrenia, with the right medication, the illness can be managed. Without it, it can be an extremely dangerous condition for those affected and for those around them, including their families. A murder trial in Sydney this week is hearing the case of Anthony Waterlow. He's charged with the murder of his father and his sister. He's pleaded not guilty on grounds of mental illness. He's currently medicated for paranoid schizophrenia and says he now understands that what he did was wrong. The case continues, so too the scientific research into a disease that affects one person in every 100. Chris Smith is our weekly science correspondent. Chris, hello there.
Hello, Fran.
Chris, being so common, the causes of schizophrenia remain something of a mystery. What is new here scientifically?
This is a very interesting paper. It's by Fred Gage, who's a well-known neuroscientist. He's based at the Salk Institute in America. And it's in the journal Nature this week, which is a sign that it's an important paper. And what these researchers have done is to take cells from the skin of four schizophrenia patients and then reprogram those cells using a genetic trick so that they become stem cells. Then they're able to persuade those stem cells to turn themselves back into brain cells, and then you can culture those brain cells in the dish and examine them in terms of their behaviour, their chemistry and their genetic behaviour, and ask how are they different compared with cells which are prepared identically but are collected from patients who don't have schizophrenia. The idea being to see if there are any obvious differences between the way these cells appear to operate. Because if you look at the brains of someone who has schizophrenia, there are some gross differences which have been spotted and a number of genes which have been linked to the disease. But actually, biochemically, how these cells operate differently in normal people and people who have schizophrenia remains something of an unknown entity. And what they found when they did this really interesting experiment was that the brain cells from the schizophrenics that they made via this route don't make as many connections as nerve cells from normal people, for a start. They also have a very different genetic profile compared with the normal people's brain cells. They found more than 596 genes which are expressed at different levels in the cells from the schizophrenics compared with the cells from normal people, and only about 25% of those genes have been spotted previously. They also found that the nerve cells from the schizophrenics make fewer outgrowths. They don't make as many branches in their nerve cell axons and dendrites, the little areoles that connect nerve cells together between the schizophrenics and the normal people. And then they also are able to start doing tests where they could put onto these cells in a dish some of the antipsychotic drugs that we give to people who have these sorts of disorders to make them function better, and then ask, well, how do these drugs affect the nerve cells? Because these are the kind of tests which we've never been able to do, and they found some really quite interesting things. In fact, I'll quote from the paper, because Kristen Brennand, who's one of the researchers, in fact the lead author on the study, she said, these drugs are doing a lot more than we thought they were doing, but now, for the very first time, we have a model system that enables us to study how these drugs work in live, genetically identical neurons from patients with known clinical outcomes, and we can start correlating the pharmacological effects, in other words, how the drugs work and what they do to cells, with the symptoms that the patients have. So you've effectively got the ability to put the patient in a dish and then try things on those cells in a dish before you subject the patient to them to see what might or might not work for that patient.
And given how heavy duty some antipsychotic drugs can be and drugs dealing with these kind of illnesses, that could help perfect or develop better drugs, obviously.
Absolutely, because one of the things that psychiatrists will tell you is that in order to manage a condition effectively, it's usually a long-term thing. You get patients under control in terms of their medication, and then you try things at levels and doses which you eventually find out via a process of trial and error suits them and gets their disease under the control so that they are functioning to the best of their ability to do so. That often, in some patients, can be very hard to achieve because some people have a resistant disease or some drugs just don't agree with them. And here we've got an opportunity to test things and actually ask, well, how do these drugs work? Do they work the same way in everybody? Clearly they don't. Can we identify the people for whom some drugs might work better than others? And then there's the whole academic side to it. Well, what actually is this disease and why does it affect some people the way it does?
Yeah. And Chris, we know from the human genome that mankind came out of Africa. Now scientists are using the study of language to chart human evolution, and language might have been the secret weapon.
Indeed, another incredible paper, this time in the journal Science, and it's by a researcher at the University of Auckland. His name's Quentin Atkinson, and he did a really interesting thing this week because what he has published is really a spin-off of the genetic studies that said people left Africa about 50,000 years ago. You can trace where people went around the world because what you do is look at the genetic diversity of populations and you can trace how those genes dilute as we go out around the world, and we know what the migration pattern is that way. And people have shown the same sort of relationship with the bugs that people carry in their stomach, Helicobacter pylori, a famous Australian. A certain person who lives in Perth was involved in that work. And also researchers in Cambridge have shown various other things with facial appearance as well. You can use the same phenotypic clues as to where people went in history. But what this Quentin Atkinson has done from the University of Auckland was to say, well, what about language? What about culture? That's pretty important too. So he took 504 languages that are spoken around the world and broke them up into how many phonemes there are. In other words, the sounds that make words mean something. And what you see, incredibly, is exactly the same relationship that's shown by the genetic studies. As you go out of Africa, you have very rich language in Africa, lots of these phonemes. And as you go out round the migratory pathway, early mankind is thought to have taken around the world, the number of these sounds that make up the words in the vocabularies of populations dwindle down. And there's a direct correlation between the two. And what he says is that actually it's pretty amazing to think that not only can we now interrogate our ancestors genetically to find out where we came from, you can also interrogate them culturally to see how language evolved all those thousands, probably 50 to 70,000 years ago. And moreover, the fact that the densest language is seen in Africa indicates that we had language starting there and people had that before they left Africa. And so this suggests that the key, the real catalyst that enabled people to start migrating, this exodus out of Africa and then around the world, could well have been language at the root of it all.
Incredible. Chris, thank you very much. Talk to
Thanks,
you again
Fran.
Next week. Chris Smith, our regular science correspondent, joining us from Cambridge in the UK. It's 17 to 7.